This is episode 395. When you eat beans, do you get bloated, fart a lot, or have stomach pain? Turns out avoiding beans and lentils might be a very bad idea for your health. Why? This is the question we answer today with Karen Hurd, known as the Bean, Lentil, and Gut Health Expert. She's a nutritionist with a background in biochemistry and ended up here after having to save her daughter's life, after she had been poisoned. Something that she was only able to do because she had military training specifically in chemical warfare. There's so much to unpack here, including conversations about how to use your diet to lower your stress hormones, cortisol and adrenaline, how to detoxify your excess hormones that can build up and get stuck in your gut, and also menopause. But where to start? Well, if beans make you gassy and you want to prevent gut-related disease, detox your system, or simply be able to enjoy a curry without pain, then this is the episode for you. So let's dive in.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? Welcome back to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. This year, it's my mission to coach 500 people to get control of their sugar cravings and sugar binges so they can stop yo-yo dieting, stop obsessing about food, and finally create a body that they feel confident being in. Links to inquire about my programs are in the show notes and or the caption down below, so scroll down, click the link, and let's chat. Now, getting into the juicy stuff here with the biochemist, the nutritionist, the myth, and the legend, Karen Hurd. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Maddie. I appreciate it.
I've been listening to your content for years at this point, so it feels very much like the myth and the legend is an appropriate comment to make in the world of health with your name.
Okay, yes. That's, I think, an appropriate comment, yes.
Well, something that I find particularly unique about you, and I'm sure everybody does, around your knowledge, is that your expertise was initially in chemical warfare as part of your time in the military. So I'm curious to know how you went from that to becoming the bean and lentil and nutrition expert that you are now.
Well, it has to do with a long, sad story, but it all turned out good in the end. I mean, we have a happy ending. So I had already ETS, it means you have your estimated time of service finished. So I had gotten out of the service as a captain in the United States Army, and I was the nuclear biological chemical defense warfare officer for my battalion when I was there at the 24th Infantry Division, mechanized. And so I was out of the service and then became a full-time stay-at-home mom, and my husband had taken a position as a pastoral assistant intern at a church in Granite City, Illinois, which is just across the river from St. Louis. If anybody ever wants to know, it's considered basically a suburb of St. Louis, even though you're in a different state. Anyway, they had prepared for our arrival to get the parsonage ready for us to live in. The parsonage was not where the current pastor was living. He was living across the river in St. Louis. And so we moved into the parsonage for our arrival. They had put down new to the house carpet. It wasn't new carpet. It was just new to the house. It was carpet that had been in some man's garage for several years. And so he said that it was still in good shape. And so they laid it in that house. And little known to us and little known to them that the carpet had been infested with carpet beetle eggs. And then when it got into the nice warm house, this was all happening in December. And so we're in the northern hemisphere, so that's the winter for us. And so cold season. And so when those eggs and hatched out with all the warmth, and then they turned into little larvae and they all came out as little carpet beetles. And there weren't 10 or 20 or 30 or a few hundred or a few thousand. There were tens of thousands of them. It was a really bad problem. And you couldn't step on them, vacuum them up, you know, you smash them, whatever. You couldn't keep up with them. I mean, we were overrun. And so we had the local exterminator and pest control come out and look at the problem. They said, oh yeah, you got a really bad problem here. So we're going to go ahead and we'll spray everybody, leave the house. This is typical what you would do. You would leave the house for the day, windows open, doesn't matter that it's cold and at that time, and you come back and, you know, all the bugs are dead. And so that's what we did, and came back, and we were there for just a few days, and all of us felt sick. And then my little girl, who was 18 months old at that time, we thought, well, you know, it's winter. We all have colds or, you know, something. And then my little girl went into grand mal seizures. And then I knew that something was wrong. Of course, we rushed her immediately to the hospital. We went to the ER, and she stopped seizing. It was less than 10 minutes, and she stopped seizing. And they did an x-ray of her lungs and said, oh, she has double pneumonia. That's why she went into seizures, and she had just a slight temperature, and it was only 100 degrees Fahrenheit, which is not a high temperature at all. It's called mild. And they said she'll just have to, you know, be on antibiotics. And anyway, they were on antibiotics and sent us back home again. And she went into seizures again when we were back into the house. And this time, of course, we rushed her to the ER. And this time they said, oh, well, first of all, she didn't stop seizing. She seized for over an hour. And these are not just little mal seizures. These are grand mal seizures. So this is where your head rolls back, your eyes roll back in your head, your head's jerking, your arms are jerking, your legs are jerking. It's a massively major event. And so she finally did stop seizing in the ER. I never forget those days. Those are burned into my memory permanently. But as we were in the ER, she was there and she was seizing, and we had to hold her, you know, from seizing off the table because she's jerking so badly, you know, she's not conscious. I mean, my husband and I were holding on to her on the exam table, and the physician had his back turned, and I mean, she'd been seizing for over an hour, and he said, there's nothing we can do. She's going to die, you know, of seizures because the lactic acid builds up, and, you know, you just can't go on that way forever. And I begged them to give her Valium, and they said, or give her, I asked them to give them atropine. And they said, no, we don't have atropine at the hospital. And I knew that atropine, by that time, I knew that it was probably going to be a nerve agent poisoning because I had already looked up what this spray had been. And so, and it was a nerve agent. And that's my training in the United States Army was, if we were ever exposed to a nerve agent, that would be the antidote is atropine. And I'd insisted to the emergency room physician, give her atropine. And he said, we don't even have atropine in the hospital. I mean, we don't, that's not in the United States Army. Troops carry that with them so that if you're exposed to a chemical agent, then you can inject yourself with that. And so he gave her Valium and said, I can't give her any more Valium. I've given her the maximum dosage. And so my husband and I stood over our little girl that was still in grand mal seizures. And he prayed over and said, dear God, you gave her to us. You can take her home. And she immediately stopped seizing. And then the emergency physician, whose back was to us, wheeled around and said, oh, we need to do an x-ray. We need to do a spinal tap. We need to, you know, to take the spinal fluid out and to see, you know, what's creating the seizure. Because they couldn't do any of this testing before. You cannot do any testing on the child that is in a grand mal seizure. You know, they're not still. And so they did all the testing and they said, oh, look, she has double pneumonia again. This is what's caused it. I said, don't you see that double pneumonia is what a person would have if they have nerve agent poisoning? And so they said, Mrs. Herr, we don't know anything about this. So anyway, we were transferred to a larger hospital, to St. Louis Children's Hospital, which is one of the finest hospitals in the United States of America as far as taking care of children. So we went by ambulance to that hospital, and she came under the care of 9 different neurologists at this very good hospital. And I asked them, I was not a wild and crazy, crying, having meltdown fits mother. I said, listen, I was United States Army, as a chemical warfare officer. These are all the signs and symptoms of a nerve agent poisoning. We just had our house sprayed with a nerve agent. Here's the name of it. Sturzband 2E, it's organophosphate. Please, it's chlorpyrifos is the active ingredient. Please do a cholinesterate level because that will show on a liver test. It's a simple blood draw. Just do a cholinesterate level. And they said, no, sir, no, 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 no. This is impossible. You do not know what you're talking about. We're the neurologists here. We're nine of us. We know what we're doing. This little girl had grand mal seizures because she had a febrile temperature of 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Like I already mentioned, is nothing. And the double pneumonia caused her to go into this. And so she needs to be on phenobarbital the rest of her life. We've got her on loading doses now. Phenobarbital is an anti-seizure drug. And so that's the real problem. And I begged them, just do this simple blood draw. They would not. And so she stayed in the hospital for several days till the double pneumonia had cleared up. And amazingly, it cleared up super fast. Of course, she's on antibiotics because that's if they think, you know, somehow or another, you got pneumonia. And it cleared up super fast, faster than ever it would. We're sent home. We get back to our house, same spray. And they had sprayed every square inch of carpet. And we had been there for a very short time. And then my little girl, she started to have all the symptoms again. Her eyes went to pinpoint. These were things that I trained my troops on for years. We even did Jody calls in the Army. When you run together as a group, you know, you have a leader that sings Jody calls. I made up all the Jody calls to train my troops on what to expect if you had nerve agent poisoning. And every single symptom she had, the pinpoint pupils, the slight cough, the diarrhea, the being out of it. And then I thought, you know, this time she's not going to seize because she's on loading doses of phenobarbital. It was on massive doses of phenobarbital. She won't seize this time. I will put her in her crib because it will seem like she's falling asleep. And I will put her in her crib and I will come in here in 30 minutes and she will be dead because her lungs have filled with fluid because this is what kills you when you're exposed to a nerve agent. And I said, I am not doing this. I don't care if every neurologist in the world thinks I'm the most idiotic person in the world. I am not going to watch my daughter die. So I left that house. I had two other children who were not well. I was not well. I was carrying a baby at that time, miscarried that baby. Everything was all downhill. My husband was sick and I left that parsonage. I said, I will never go back until I get to the bottom of this. And so I started to call all nerve agent, or started to call all poison control centers that we have in the United States here. So in Chicago, in Dallas, everywhere. And all of them to tell the story to the receptionist who answers the phone. And then, you know, they talk about, well, did this and that. Anyway, no answers. I finally got a hold of the poison control center in Dallas, Texas. And they said, well, we don't know, but you should be talking to this child toxicologist who works at the university in Corvallis. And he might know. And I thought, well, I'll call him. I'm calling everybody in the United States of America that I could. And so I called him and go through with his receptionist again, who I am. They said, well, you know, Dr. Sheldon Wagner, he's here right now. You could just speak to him. It's like, really? I get to speak to somebody that might know something, you know? And so he got on the phone line with me and I told him the story. He said, absolutely, she could be poisoned. Did you have the carpet tested for levels of organophosphate? And I said, the lab in St. Louis is requiring a large amount of money down payment because they have to recalibrate their instruments. My husband is a pastoral intern and we have no money. I mean, we didn't have any money. We were poor as church mice. It's a true expression. And so he said, I have the lab here in my university. He said, cut out pieces this size, send them to me on dry ice by next day air because already, you know, so many days have passed, it breaks down. The chlorpyrifos breaks down over time. Send it to me on dry ice. And are you nursing your baby? I said, yes, that's the only thing she'll do. She won't eat anything else. She's still not feeling well. He said, send me a sample of your breast milk. And we did everything he told us to do. We sent it all to him. The next day he calls us the next day after he tests it, which is, we're talking about a turnaround in, you know, less than 48 hours, all of it. And he calls, he said, your levels of chlorpyrifos in that carpet are over 100 times the safe level. Your little girl has been poisoned. Why hasn't your doctor done a cholinesterase level? And I said, I tried to get them to do that. He said, give me your physician's name immediately. I'm calling them. He called them. They called me less than half an hour after this. I give him the number of my physician's calling me, or my daughter's physician. And he says, Mrs. Hurd, could you bring your little girl in for cholinesterase level? Yes, the one that I tried to get before. Yes, we'll come in. We took her in. They did the cholinesterase level. Guess what? She's poisoned. There we go. So now starts the whole, what are we going to do about it? Because she was very sick. I mean, she was not eating. She was wasting away. Her liver enzymes were off the charts because then they checked all her liver enzymes, what they hadn't done before. And they, you know, now they're all of this, she's been poisoned coming through. And so what are we going to do about it? And they didn't have any answers. They said, we don't know what to do about it. We, you know, her liver is failing. And if your liver fails you, that's it. You know, there's nothing to be done anymore. You will die. And her immune system is completely compromised. And I said, well, there's something, somewhere, something I can do. We saw specialists. We took her to Chicago to see specialists. We saw specialists in St. Louis. And we conferred on by phone to specialists in Dallas. And they all had the same prognosis. There's nothing that can be done. Her liver is completely failing. Her liver is deteriorating. And there's nothing we can do nothing. I will never forget the day that I sat in the specialist's office in St. Louis. And the specialist said, Mrs. Hurd, we have never seen anyone die of organophosphate poisoning before and watch the liver deteriorate. So we would like to do regular liver biopsies every few days and just take a chunk of Ruth's liver. They're very painful tests. It's not a test, it's a biopsy, so that we can just examine the liver tissue as she dies. And I said, no. I'm done.
What an awful request.
It's an awful request. And I said, I'm done. I'm out of here. I don't want to have anything to do with you. No one can help me anywhere. I've gone to everybody I know. So I went to the university there in St. Louis. It's Washington University. It's a medical school. And I went to the library and I presented myself to the librarian. I said, I know nothing about medicine. All I know is I have a degree in Spanish, an undergrad degree in Spanish. I said, I have no nutritional training or medical training. I know nothing. But I have to learn everything I can about the liver and about organophosphates. And is there a way to cover the liver? And she's just a librarian. She says, okay, well, this is how you use the microfiche, because we're talking 1989 and the early 1990. Okay. So everything was still, there was no, you know, you can Google things and get on your browser and type in and you can bring up all, no, there's none of that. We're on microfiche. Okay. So she shows me how to use the microfiche machine and says, well, points me over here. You should start over here. This is, you know, where we have these type of articles. And that's what I did. I started to read and read and read and read and read article after article. I read everything from every snake oil remedy to the latest research that the National Institutes of Health was doing. And I came up with, I learned a lot about what's called the enterohepatic recirculation, about how we recycle things for the liver clears. And I came up with my very own plan. Nothing was in the literature except just how things work. And so based on how things work, how soluble fiber has an impact on enterohepatic recirculation, then I came up with my own plan. And then I instituted it. By this time, Bruce was really bad. I mean, I didn't know if she was even going to make it. And so I started to feed her soluble fiber, was the main thing that I fed her, and that was beans, and she wouldn't eat it. So I have to grind everything up and put it in an oral syringe and force her to swallow it because she didn't want to eat anything. She was so sick at that time. Anyway, she started to recover and she got better and she got better. Until she was well. And then the doctors, then they said, we can't believe this. Her liver enzymes are normal. What are you doing? We cannot believe this. Little girl that was supposed to die lives. And so, hooray, happy ending to the story. We think that's the end of it. And so, but little known to me, I didn't know that it was not the end of it. It was the end of it for Ruth because she recovered. But I started to get phone calls and said, is this Karen Hurd? I said, yes, it's Karen Hurd. Well, you know, I understand that you healed your little girl, and I have, my son is this, my father is this, my brother, my sister, my aunt, my uncle, they have this problem, and the doctors haven't been able to help them. Can you help them? I said, no, I can't help them. I don't know anything. I said, I don't, you know, I'm not a nurse, I'm not a doctor, I'm not any medical profession at all. Yeah, but the doctors say they can't help them, and you found a solution for your daughter. Can you find a solution for me? And so you hear these terrible stories that'll break your heart. And I said, well, I could go down to Washington University. And now I'm very familiar with microfiche and how to read things on a microfiche reader. And I could look it up. And so I would look it up and I'd say, if it were me, and of course I have no drugs, I have I can't prescribe anything. The only thing I have at my use is food. If it was me, I wouldn't be eating this, but I would be eating this. And then people began to get well. And then more people call me. And by the way, how did they get my number? I didn't even know. How do you get my number? How did these people find out who I am? I mean, we're not putting it out on some newsletter or podcast. There wasn't any of that stuff back then. There was an article published in the St. Louis Globe Democrat, a little tiny article, because somebody said, oh, well, we read it in the newspaper. What newspaper? Nobody called and interviewed me. You know. Anyway, little newspaper. I mean, I finally got a copy. It was just this little paragraph. Little girl who was destined to die lives. And then they just had a little brief, you know, summary of what happened. It's just like, okay. So eventually then, I started to get phone calls from people saying, like the Drury Inns, we do brown bag luncheons. We would like you to come speak at our brown bag. This is where their employees sit around, you know, in their lunch hour. And then they have, you know, financial counselors come in or advisors or whatever. And then one Bell Telephone called me. They had the largest building in St. Louis. It's in the tallest, the one Bell Tower, largest skyscraper in St. Louis with thousands and thousands and thousands of employees. And they said, we want you to come and start lecturing us. So I started doing lectures to the employees there on a regular basis. And then everything just exploding. And then eventually the University of Missouri called me and said, we have heard so much about you and we have so many demands that you come and begin to teach. And I said, I don't have a degree. They said, we know, we'd like you to get one. And so then I started working on getting my credentials in nutrition, and then I set up my own private practice. And then here I am almost, basically, I've spent 30 years now, 30 years later, that I have a very wide international practice. I've since also gotten a master's degree in biochemistry and just finished a master's degree in public health. So that's how it all began. And Ruth is now in her 30s, and she's healthy and well, and she's married, and she has two little children.
Mum, mother, grandmother, nan, nana, and women with no kids. Have I got your attention? So, I want you to imagine something. Go with me here. Imagine a life where even when you wake up tired and the kids are driving you mad and work sucks and things are problematic, that you're still in control of your food and you still make healthy choices without giving up and binging on chocolate and wine and saying, I'll try again tomorrow. It might be hard to imagine, but having freedom with your food is absolutely possible. And it starts by getting three things right. One, having a supportive community, building a strong connection with fellow emotional eating warriors. Two, having the right information delivered in the right way. And three, having a guide that can shine a light on the right path and have your back along the way. And that's me. Those three things are exactly what we've got for you inside the Healthy Mums Collective Facebook group for people just like you wanting to end their emotional eating and feel good in their own skin again. And currently, it's free to join. The link is in the show notes below. If you've struggled with diets or felt powerless around food, you're not alone. But let me assure you, this is a community that understands your battles and is ready to empower you into action. So what can you expect on the inside? Well, we have posts and content that push you a little out of your comfort zone. We do Facebook Lives, have interactive Q&A session, and it's simply a safe space to face your food challenges and be honest without concern of being judged. If you decide to join us, I have a complimentary How to Turn Food into Self-Confidence ebook for you as well, completely free. The Healthy Mums Collective thrives on support, authenticity, and experience-based practices. It's a community, so the beautiful people in it is where the magic comes from. To join us and be a part of that magic, head to the show notes, click the link, breeze through a few quick questions, and you'll be in the Healthy Mums Collective before you know it. Again, the link is in the show notes below. I'll see you in the DMs or on the welcome post in just a few moments.
Wow, what a journey. Yeah, thank you so much for walking us through each one of those steps and that journey. It sounds like obviously a roller coaster, and in many ways, the path to nutrition chose you rather than you choosing it per se. But I'm very happy that it's a good outcome. I've of course got the question, which everybody listening will be curious about. What were the beans doing?
It's the soluble fiber that's found in beans. Soluble fiber is in many foods, but the richest source of soluble fiber is found in beans. We have a system. Our liver is in charge of clearing out all fat-soluble waste in the human body. It's a really important detox job that the liver is doing, because if it does not work, you can die in 24 hours. If any of these fat-soluble wastes, and a lot of it's our own production or our own hormones, if those things are not cleared out, then you can die in 24 hours. Like our other detox systems, like our kidneys, they are filtering out water-soluble things. If your kidneys completely fail you, you can live for 2 weeks. Your lymphatic system is another detox organ, or not, it's not an organ, it's a system actually that works through different lymph nodes, and the spleen is also a part of the lymphatic system. If that fails you, parts of it, a lot of women during breast removals, like for mastectomies, during cancer, you know, surgeries, they'll have many lymph nodes taken out. Oftentimes people have lymph nodes in your spleen could be removed, especially football players oftentimes will, you know, get injuries and their spleen is removed. You can live the rest of your life without part of your lymphatic system. But when you mess with the liver and it doesn't work, you can die in 24 hours flat. It is the most powerful detoxification system we have in the human body. And so the way it gets rid of all the waste that is clearing is that it clears it from the bloodstream and it puts it into a digestive fluid called bile. And the bile leaves the liver and goes down via the gallbladder. And there is a duct that leads directly from the liver into the duodenum, but most of it goes through the gallbladder and then from the gallbladder goes into the duodenum. The duodenum is the first part of the small colon. And so it's just right underneath, it's right here at the upper part of your rib cage in the center. So it's just below the sternum and above your belly button is where the duodenum is located. And so all this bile gets dumped into the duodenum, and then it eventually travels down into the jejunum, that's the middle part of the small colon, and into the ileum. And the ileum is the last part of the small colon. And the ileum is connected by a valve called the ileocecal valve into the large colon. But something very interesting happens at that terminal part of the ileum, so you're still in the small colon, is that fats are absorbed from that place in the terminal part of the ileum. We don't absorb fats in our mouth. We don't absorb fats in our stomach. We don't absorb fats in the duodenum or the jejunum. We only absorb them in the ileum, and very specifically, the vast majority in the terminal part of the ileum. Well, what is bile made out of? Bile is made out of fat, because that's the only thing you can put fat-soluble toxins into. You have to put them into a fat carrier, a molecule of fat. And so your bile recycles. How much bile recycles? When I was studying back on those microfish, they thought it was about 90% of bile is recycled. Now, since I've, you know, continued my studies, now we know it's 95% of all bile recycles. So that means 95% of these fat-soluble waste that are being pulled out of your bloodstream are dumped back into your bloodstream constantly. And you're only getting rid of 5% of them. Well, yep. It's enough to keep you alive, but then you're also keep clearing them. It's just this constant process of clearing them. And so what breaks that up is the consumption of soluble fiber. Soluble fiber loves fat soluble waste. There's a bond that is made. It's a net that it creates. Soluble fiber is a very many branch polysaccharide. And so it forms like a close mesh net, and it captures these fat molecules. And soluble fiber cannot be absorbed in the intestinal tract, and anything bound to it will also not be absorbed. And so just imagine this scenario, Maddie. You're eating beans, which have your highest amount of soluble fiber. You're releasing this fat soluble toxic load and bile into your duodenum. And these two substances, the soluble fiber and the beans, see each other from across a crowded duodenum, and they rush into each other's arms and they get married. And there is no such word as divorce. And so this now complex molecule travels through the duodenum, the jejunum, and reaches the terminal part of the ileum. And the fat says, hey, I absorb right here at the terminal part of the ileum. So I'm breaking up the relationship here, and I am going back into the bloodstream via the portal vein and going to recycle like I've been doing for all my life. And the soluble fiber says, oh, honey, I forgot to tell you this up there in the duodenum before we got married. There is no such word as divorce. And we're together forever. And I'm going into the toilet in the form of a bowel movement. And buddy, you're coming with me. And they fly through the ileocecal valve into the large colon. They make it through all the large colon, and they're excreted in the form of a bowel movement. And you threw the bile away. And that's what I did for Ruth. We started to throw away the bile because in the bile was the organophosphate that was just continuing to recycle and destroy her. And we were able to throw that poison into the toilet. And so how does that help people today? Because we all are exposed to fat-soluble waste. People are worried about the glycophosphates that are in, you know, all the things that we spray on our farm fields. They're worried about the bisphenol A that are in the plastics. We're worried about PFAS, which is the forever chemical, which is a plastic. We're worried about so many things. Eat soluble fiber. It is easy. All these things are easily cleared out of the bloodstream by your liver. You clear those things out, then you eat the soluble fiber, they go into the toilet. We don't have to be worried about all these things if you would just eat soluble fiber. And do you have to eat it every 20 minutes? No, just have it at breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Eat a half a cup of beans, not uncooked beans, cooked. So a half a cup of cooked beans is not a chore to eat. And then that will then pull out what you're recycling. Now, then if you have a problem like with Ruth, I mean, that's all I was giving her. I mean, it was just soluble fiber. She was dying. Then, yes, you want to do it more often. But just for good measure, everybody should be eating beans 3 times a day.
The natural question that comes up for most people at this part of the conversation is that, and it's very common, you know, working in the field of nutrition, is that people that, you know, when they eat beans and or lentils, that they get bloating, they get pain, they get gas. And so for that reason, that's an indicator to them that they shouldn't be eating beans and lentils. And so my question to you is, one, why do a lot of people, particularly in the white Western world, react to beans in that way? And what should they do in order to make it a more comfortable experience to be able to eat those kind of foods?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I want to make sure I tie that the passing of gas is gas, and the bloating, a lot of people don't understand that bloating is gas also. It's just trapped and it's not being passed. You're not burping it out, or you're not passing it as flatulence. And when it's trapped, that's what creates the pain, because you just blow up like a balloon and, you know, you're not getting rid of the gas. So what's creating the gas? For the people that have gas, I need to ask them this question, because if they answer honestly, then I already know their answer, and it will be yes. Do you have gas anyway? And do you have gas when you eat other foods? Do you have gas? Mm-hmm. And the answer is yes, but it's worse when I eat beans. Yes, because beans can be fermented. What creates gas is the fermentation process. We have two ways to digest foods. One is through a pathway of what are called digestive enzymes. We all make digestive enzymes in our gastrointestinal tract. Those digestive enzymes break down our food into smaller portions so that they can be absorbed and cross the intestinal barrier. There is a second way to digest foods, and that is through the process of fermentation. Fermentation works in a different chemical pathway, and as a result of that particular chemical pathway, you will always produce gas. CH4, very specifically, CH4 is called methane. And so it's a gas, and it has a stinky smell, and it, whether you burp it up or you pass it as flatulence. And so the fermentation process creates gas. The digestive enzyme process does not. So what determines if you're going to process by digestive enzymes or fermentation? That is the function of hormones. The more hormones you are producing, the more you will ferment your foods, and the less the digestive enzyme process will come into play. Hormones are cleared from the bloodstream and cleared from the bloodstream by the liver, because hormones are made out of fats, and placed into the digestive fluid bile. Bile is going down to your gut. So if a person is eating beans and they have a lot of flatulence and gas and the pain and from the bloating, that is because they are overproducing, or they have been over recycling hormones for a long time, and they have a large content of hormones in their bile fluid. And hormones are different from other molecules. Everything that we eat, we think about it breaking down. We think about things in the bloodstream, cholesterol being broken down from an LDL molecule, that's a low-density lipoprotein molecule, into its constituent parts, which is a triglyceride. Everything gets broken down into smaller little pieces. Not so with hormones. Hormones are very, very little tiny molecules already, and they trigger reaction. And it goes from a taut to a relaxed state, a molecule. And it's really cool chemistry when you look into it. But anyway, they will trigger reaction to happen. And then they go on to another molecule and trigger reaction. They're just triggering pathways to start. And they just go from molecule to molecule, trigger. It's like turning on a light switch. And it just turns on the light switch and they go on. A hormone does not get used up. It doesn't say, oh, I gave myself to this chemical reaction, and then I'm used up in the process. Not so with a hormone. It just triggers a receptor site on a cell wall of a molecule, and then it just goes on to continue to trigger reaction. It's never used up. And so the liver can break down a hormone, but very rarely does. There's no point in it, because there's such tiny molecules. So you just toss it into the bile and you throw it out of the body, hopefully, through eating soluble fiber. If you have not been eating soluble fiber in your lifetime, you have been recycling all kinds of fat soluble waste. And number one on that list is the hormones. And those hormones are triggering that fermentation pathway. So what do? You start with one bean. You eat a bean. You're not going to get a lot of gas from one bean. And then you say, I had no gas from one bean. Good. Next meal, have two beans. You're okay with two beans? Fine. Okay. Now you're at three beans. Maybe you have a little gas. Okay. Just stay at three beans until you don't have gas from that, because that little bit of soluble fiber is going to begin to carry out some of those hormones that are creating the fermentation process. And then you eventually catch up. And we can also use psyllium too. Psyllium is a soluble fiber that is just, it has the same five. There's several different types of soluble fiber, and mucilages and hemocellulose, and there, anyway, it doesn't really matter what they all are, but psyllium is equivalent to beans. Not, there's other different, you know, inulin, and there's other fibers, but they don't carry the impact that the beans do. So you'd have to use psyllium. Psyllium can't be fermented because there's no carbohydrates there. People say, well, I read on the label it has this many carbohydrates. If the United States, I don't know where it is where you are, but in the United States, a fiber is considered a carbohydrate, which is just wrong. I mean, that's the FDA that needs to change that, but I'm not at the federal level in politics, so I'm not going to worry about changing all their rules. But it has no calories. Calories means that it gives you some sort of energy. There are no calories in soluble fiber. It's like eating a piece of sawdust. I mean, there's no calories there that you're going to be able to metabolize. And so beans, though, have other carbohydrates. They have a soluble fiber, but they have carbohydrates, too. And it's carbohydrates that are being fermented. So if you eat psyllium, there are no carbohydrates there. And then nothing can be fermented. If you still have gas, it's because you ate something else that was a carbohydrate. You had a piece of bread. You had some potatoes. You had whatever you had. You had broccoli. You had cauliflower. You had whatever you ate. And so those are carbohydrates. So you can either use a psyllium or you just work up to little by little.
I'm curious to ask, in regards to hormones, are we talking just sex hormones in regards to what comes through and gets recycled and needs detoxification for using this fiber, this insoluble fiber, or are we talking all the hormones?
It is all the hormones. Sex hormones certainly are included in that, but it's adrenaline. And adrenaline is really important because if you have a washing of adrenaline, which is actually two hormones called epinephrine and norepinephrine, you are going to have anxiety. When you have too much adrenaline, you move into having panic attacks and anxiety. And so if you're nervous and you're feeling your heart pound, by the way, that's all adrenaline, because you have to give a speech or whatever, you're going to see your boss and you think he's going to chew you out or something like that, then you just need to be eating a few spoonfuls of beans every 20 minutes and that will slam it down. I work with a lot of actors and people who are on stage, and they'll say, what can I do to calm all my, you know, stage jitters? I said, just eat beans every few minutes before you go on stage, you know, and it works. They all call me. I can't believe it. I was so calm. I went out there, was able to perform, no problem, you know. Yeah, it's because it took away all that adrenaline.
I'm curious in the conversation around beans. Well, actually, I want to go two directions here. Actually, I want to go about 45. But the question around most people's issue in their guts, obviously, with beans, and the relationship with stress, is that just a sign of the modern world? And I ask that question in regards to, one, the food system producing maybe beans that aren't of amazing quality, or the other side of that equation, which is that life is so incredibly stressful that nobody can keep up with their adrenaline and cortisol production.
It is my opinion that it is wholly the latter, not the former, that our lives are so incredibly stressful that we're not keeping up with it. Because the beans, I mean, to be a bean, you have to have soluble fiber. I mean, there isn't a bean that is without soluble fiber. Yeah. Well, everybody knows the stressful world in which we live. I mean, there's something around us. And then added to that is that we're eating foods that create adrenaline. When you eat sugar, when you take in a caffeinated beverage, when you're eating, you know, junk, then you're going to increase your adrenaline production. And you will, and specifically caffeine too. Caffeine is well known to increase the sex hormone production, especially estrogen. So you are creating those things because of the diet that you're eating. And then you've left out legumes. I mean, beans used to be a normal part, at least in the United States, of everyone's diet. And then in the early 1900s in the United States, we had the advent of the flour mill. And it used to be people ate beans for breakfast. I mean, that was just, you know, you have beans. That was just every meal you had beans. But then we had the advent of the flour mill, and then you could grind wheat into flour really easily without, you know, between two rocks and pounding, you know, all that was gone. We had flour mills then. What would you rather have for breakfast, a bowl of beans, or would you like to have toast and jam? Well, we all want to have bread. We want to have toast. That's better than beans, right? There's not the soluble fiber in bread. And so our whole way of eating changed, at least in the United States, after the early 1900s. And we lost all of that soluble fiber.
And how does this go in regards to the conversation around menopause? Does it help women that are going through perimenopause or menopause in a really challenging way with their hormones? Do beans help them make that process much easier?
It can. That's not the key critical piece in menopause, however. Menopause is where the ovaries are no longer going to carry out the function of producing estrogen. There's several different types of estrogen, and there's the estrogen that the ovaries produce that is very potent that makes a woman be able to have children. And so the ovaries have a certain lifespan. And when a woman is reaching that 50-year mark, 51 is the average age of menopause in the United States. I don't know about where you live, but in the United States, it's age 51. When you are reaching that, the ovaries are literally shriveling up. An ovary is about the size of a plump almond. That's how tiny they are. And as you grow older, then that ovary shrivels up and it becomes this, it looks like a dried up raisin. You know, I mean, a dried up hard little raisin, and it's not able to produce estrogen for you anymore. The gland that begins to produce that estrogen for you is the adrenal glands. They're the glands that produced estrogen for you prior to her menarche. Menarche was when she's in her teens and she begins to have menstrual cycles. That prior to that time, she was still a little girl and she wasn't a little boy. And so little girls think differently than little boys, by the way. I know that you were a little boy. I was a little girl. And we think, and I had brothers and I had sister. And so we think differently and we act differently, okay? And that is because the human anatomy for little girls, they're producing actually a little more estrogen than the little boys do. I mean, that's just the way that we are genetically put together. Where was that estrogen produced before that little girl's ovaries had matured and ripened that they could produce this more powerful estrogen? That was all produced in the adrenal glands. And the same thing for little boys. Before they go through maturation and go through puberty, their testosterone is produced in the adrenal glands. And so when a woman goes through menopause and her ovaries are shutting down and they literally are not going to produce estrogen anymore, then the brain tells the pituitary, and the pituitary is part of an endocrine system. It's the master control gland of producing hormones. It's telling the adrenals, hey, you need to make more estrogen for this woman. And then the adrenal glands, if they have been stressed throughout this woman's, you know, over these last, you know, number of, you know, decades, that she's under more stress, she's eating sugar, she's exposed to perfumes and fragrances, which I haven't even touched on because that is a big adrenal stimulant and hormonal stimulant. And when you continue to stress a gland over and over through the years, then you're going to ask it to take on an additional job? No, this is what happens with women that have menopausal problems. They're asking their adrenals to start picking up the function of making estrogen, which they have not made for at least 3 or 4 decades, depending on, you know, when the woman went through menarche and when she's going through menopause. And so you're saying now, adrenal glands, I know you haven't made any estrogen for a long time because you haven't needed to because the ovaries have been doing that job. Now, I need you to make estrogen again. And you know what the adrenals say? Back off, Jack. Are you kidding? I'm not going to make any estrogen for you. I can barely keep up with the adrenaline demands this woman wants. Oh, and she wants some cortical steroid. And she's looking for aldosterone. And she's looking for all these hormones that I make. She puts me under stress every day because look at her diet. She's an awful eater. And then she's under this stressful situation with her family and her job and whatever else is going on. Are you kidding? You think that I have time to make estrogen? Drop dead. I'm not doing it. And it doesn't. And then you don't get enough estrogen. And then you have the crying spells and you have all this, the symptoms of the headaches and insomnia and blah, blah, blah. Women who go through menopause, they know what all these symptoms are. It's miserable. It's just because you can't make the estrogen the adrenal complex because you have so worn it out over the years. So what do? Soluble fiber is important for everybody. You would be eating beans 3 times a day, just like every normal person should be eating 3 times a day. But what you have to do is you have to heal the adrenals. You have to take away all the things that have stressed it through the years. And then you'll find out that it's actually protein is the biggest healing factor for the adrenal glands to get good, adequate protein.
I had this conversation yesterday with a friend of mine, Veronica Smith, who's been on the podcast before. She's a chef from here in Australia, and around the conversation with stress in regards to hormones and menopause and perimenopause. And no one seems to take it very seriously. And I just think that that's a combination of factors that nobody wants to be left behind. And it seems too simple. It's like, oh, just do less. Well, you know, Maddie, have you tried living in the Western world and just doing less?
No, I live in a very stressful Western world too. And so, and I'm involved in extremely stressful events. I'd mentioned to you before that I'm in politics, and you want to get into stress, get into politics anyway. So, but if you're eating your beans, then you can handle it. People say, Carol, how can you be so calm? How can you be, you know, you're passionate about what you do, but you're so calm and, you know, your speech is on the floor and all the rest of it. It's because I eat beans and I don't eat any of the bad things that are going to create more stress on me so that you can handle stress. Yeah.
And so a question I have is also about Southeast Asians in comparison to us white Westerners. So we're talking sort of Sri Lanka, India, Pakistan, you know, and probably Central America as well, where they have a lot of beans and lentils in their diet naturally. Is it as simple for us as just re-exposing our guts and our bodies to these beans, having them regularly, and then our tolerance and ability to process and benefit from them will be just the same as the people that eat curry every day?
Yes, it is that simple. It is that simple. We just need to add the soluble fiber to our diet. And it is good to get rid of all these no items, like, you know, I rattled off just a moment ago, all the sweets and the caffeine and the perfumes and fragrances too. But, you know, in a lot of these countries, they're not eating, and I don't know, I'd have to actually study the current diet of that particular country. But I mean, they're probably getting more legumes than we are, the soluble fiber, and they may be eating a whole lot less sweets than Americans do, because I don't know if you've been over here in America, but I will tell you, you want to come to a country that is or after sweets. I mean, you have to have a sweet for breakfast, you got to have a dessert after lunch and a dessert after dinner, and you're not a good American unless you have a bowl of ice cream before you go to bed. So we are sweet fanatics over here.
It's exactly the same here in Australia. We maybe not as overt about it as sort of the American culture might be, but it's very similar here. Very high obesity, very high, you know, handful of chronic diseases that are produced by just lifestyles of stress and poor nutrition. So I think this information that we're talking about today hopefully will land with people in a way that means that they pick it up and start adding this soluble fiber or insoluble fiber to their diet and improving their hormone profile. But obviously, you probably can't out-bean a hyper-stressful lifestyle. So you probably need to also work on the stress.
Yes, it helps work on the stress too.
Amazing. So where can everybody find you online? Because obviously everyone listening is thinking, I need more of Karen. She's clearly amazing. So where do we send them?
It's just KarenHurd.com. It's just my name, KarenHurd.com, KarenHurd.com. And you can just put that into your internet browser and my website will pop up.
Fantastic. I'll put that link down in the show notes below and the caption below so people can get their hands on it and jump into your world. And for us to finish, what is one piece of health information you wish more people knew about?
Well, since we already talked about the beans and everybody knows they should be trying to get a half a cup 3 times a day, half cup at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, then I will tell you the number one item that you are consuming that is destroying you is sugar. Get rid of it. Get rid of your sweets. Get rid of it. And it's very addictive. It'll be very hard for you at the beginning. But if you just say, I will not eat it anymore, cut it off totally, abrupt withdrawal, it'll take you 2 weeks to come through the withdrawal of eating sweets. But then you stop craving it. Never go back to it. It will destroy you.
Yes, you are preaching the same knowledge and wisdom right there that I am banging on the drum of every day on this podcast. So thank you for echoing those sentiments. And thank you for joining us here on the show. I hope that we can catch up again soon.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me, Maddie. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no worries. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learnt anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.